21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
My shoes are worn out, walking down this same highway.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus, my executive producer and research assistants, Laura Cortner, and our engineer. Our engineer is Noah Dankner, and I understand he is up for another award. It's possible that he may have bench-pressed 800 pounds, and he only weighs 110. Now, that's extraordinary stuff. Okay, well, boy, shocking, isn't it? Well, Druid Hill Park is a magical place to be, and over a stretch of 10 years in the late 60s, I visited this most beautiful park nearly every day. Several years ago, I was asked by the Sun Papers about my favorite place to be, and here is my full, unedited reply. The most magical place in my hometown is Druid Hill Park. Ever since I was little and my father regaled me with tales of their families sleeping in the park with their wallets lying out beside them, I've known this place to be very special. Its name alone acted as a magnet for me, and I spent many an hour deep in philosophical discussion with fellow travelers theorizing on the source of that name. Before air conditioning, we sought refuge here with long walks, learning from the statues, visiting the zoo, communicating with my friends the eagles, and then Zahara's and my unforgettable discovery one day of an abandoned group, a cache of maybe they're Native American stones, probably not, but they were carved with Phoenician symbols. And I'll never forget the once yearly art show around that lake that would put enough money in a starving artist's pockets to feed me for the rest of the summer. It was a magical place indeed. Now this hour, we're going to talk about my favorite book on this magical place called Druid Hill Park, The Heart of Historic Baltimore, and it's by Eden Unger Baldich and Andrade, who is joining us tonight. Andrade, Park Administrator, Baltimore City Department of Recreation and Parks, noted in the preface of this book, "On summer days, a visitor can sit in air conditioning under their oak groves or spy a healthy red fox trotting quietly across the back roads. Recently, more people have been discovering the charms of the park with its fantastic view of downtown, along with the 1.5-mile exercise path around the reservoir. A new treat is the 2.75-mile trail winding from south to north, touching many park features. Druid Hill Park offers a retreat from the harsh urban surfaces and noise of the city. It plays a vital role in the health and well-being of our citizens. It is free and open to all, and it's located right in the heart of the city." Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Andrade.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Can I call you Ann?
Please do.
Thank you. Because that's your name, right?
Excellent, yes.
And when did you first become involved with Druid Hill Park?
Well, I started working for the city parks in 2000. And in 2005, I became the Jones Falls Trail Administrator, and the trail was being built, was being planned through the park at that time, and that's when I really got involved in it.
What did you think of it then, in the very beginning? Has your opinion changed any?
Oh, my opinion has changed dramatically as I got to know it more and more. What I started doing is organizing a friends group around the park when the trail was coming through, and I didn't know the park that well. But there had been a friends group years ago, and it had died down, and it had been dormant for a long time. And I started kind of reinvigorating it, and all these people came out of the woodwork around the park who had grown up there and loved it, and new people came in who had been moving to Baltimore. And I got to know the parks. I feel like I know the park extremely well as anybody else in the city.
Well, if anyone reads your book, then they're going to know the park so much better than they ever thought. I just love this book. It really is terrific.
Well, I love the park. I think it's an amazing thing. And it's, you know, I think there's, it's well used in many ways, but I also think a lot of people don't really know much about the park or how, you know, it's 745 acres.
Is that all?
It's only 100 acres smaller than Central Park in New York. Mm-hmm. So it's massive. And I just, people don't know that about it.
Well, let's get to this history. What was the property before it was a park?
Well, it was, it had been a plantation back in the 1700s, so that, you know, they were growing 40,000 pear trees, and they had slaves who were working on the park at that time, and it was owned by two main families who were both from Scotland, England, and the Rogers family and the Buchanans, and they, over 150 years of the history, when they owned the park, the two families intermarried two times. I mean, they were big; they were prominent Baltimore families.
This is the Rogers and Buchanan families,
right? Right, and they were both from England, Scotland. So we think, you know, when we were researching the book to find out about the name Druid Hill, which you mentioned earlier, we couldn't exactly pinpoint how or why they named the park, but we knew they were both kind of Scottish Celtic origin, so we figured that, you know, the Druids were the Celtic priests, and the oak trees were very related to their religion, and so we just felt like that's how the name came about, even though we couldn't actually pinpoint.
Well, the thing I enjoyed, well, there are a lot of things I enjoyed about this book, but learning the history of these two families and the kind of repetitions of history within the families, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, as I said, they both came from England, Scotland, but they came, you know, separately. The Rogers were over here first, and they were part of the very early settling of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones who started buying up some of the property. First, Lord Baltimore was purchasing the property from the Susquehannock Indians, who were there first.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also being given out to, you know, carpenters. At that point, at the early times, carpenters had to have fields of, or they had to have woodlots in order to provide wood for people. But the Rogers started buying that up, and then the Buchanans came over and married one of the Rogers and started buying up more property. And as you know, they were both rooted in, became very rooted in Baltimore, and educated similarly. And
there was the repetition of the name Eleanor,
right?
And also a repetition of
Nicholas Rogers.
Yeah,
there were four Nicholas Rogers.
Whoa,
who came down the line, and Eleanor Buchanan Rogers.
Well, the thing also was it eventually came into the hands of the city of Baltimore. And I must tell you, this is so dramatically written about the last of the individuals that owned it. I think, was that a Buchanan?
No, it was a Rogers.
I'm sorry.
It was the last of the line of the Rogers.
The
Nicholas Rogers.
He was kind of tough, wasn't he?
Yeah, he had been married a couple of times to pretty prominent women who were, you know, the granddaughter of Martha Washington, and his first wife died, and then he married the granddaughter of James Madison. But they both died young.
Mm-hmm.
He became kind of cantankerous old guy. And his daughter Eleanor kind of took care of him. And when the city was looking for a large piece of property to become a park, they really kind of forced his hand to acquire Druid Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he died within a month of the park being his land becoming a park. He was very tied to the property.
He sure was. He had a very very large basement filled with all types of wonderful drinks. And I was wondering what happened to all that. Did the city of Baltimore end up owning that, or did he take it with him? I don't know.
You know, there's no record. We don't know whether it went with him or what happened when the city got involved in that. I have no indication of that.
Yeah, especially with Mayor Swan there. I learned a great deal about it. This book is just a wonderful book from the standpoint of now I know more about all of these names. So I want to thank you the 50th time. For making sure this was done, because I had all kinds of, I've even had dreams of Druid Hill Park. And I was serious. I went there every day for 10 years.
What were you doing there?
Oh, what happened was I found that there were certain areas where a lot of African-American boys were playing baseball, but they didn't have any gloves, and they didn't have any bats, and they didn't have any balls. So since I've always liked playing baseball, I would go to secondary places like Goodwill, and I'd buy up 10 gloves, and I'd buy up a couple old bats and some brand-new balls, and I would go. And during the afternoons, we'd start early afternoon, and we would play games of baseball. Mm. And it was thrilling. It was thrilling because they got to keep the equipment, and of course, some of their parents got a little bit worried. Who is this white guy playing baseball with their kids? But it really worked out well. I had a wonderful time with them. And then there were other times I would just go see the Eagles. And there was a golden eagle, and there was a bald-headed eagle. And I was fascinated by them and the importance of eagles as far as this country goes. So there it was for multiple reasons. I never got to the swimming pools or anything like that, but I just also loved the conservatory. That was another world altogether.
It still is.
Yes, I know. It's better than ever.
Right. I would recommend, if there are people listening and they haven't been to the conservatory, that's kind of a magical place in Baltimore.
It sure is. Just the vision of visual things, and then the smells. Whoa, it's just otherworldly. It's just otherworldly.
Yeah.
Well, what about the most of us know Druid Hill's buildings as the mansion. I think that's the last of the buildings that.
That was the only piece of property that was left when the city bought it. The mansion. It had been the third sited house at that location, which is one of the highest locations in the park. And you could, at that time, see down to the harbor. That's how high it was.
Wow.
You'd have a view to the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And the first two both caught on fire. But the last one, built in 1801, is still there. When the city purchased it, they put a porch around it and did a number of things for a number of years afterwards. But the mansion house still exists, and it's the same age as the Homewood House, which is over on the Hopkins campus.
But when was that? That the same age,
1801 was 1801. The mansion house. So it was right around the same time.
Boy, they sure had a lot of fires in those days, didn't they?
They had a lot of fires. Yeah.
Whoa!
We still do.
Well, you know, I didn't notice that.
Not in the park, luckily.
Yeah. Now there appears to be, and all this cemetery is something else. The Rogers Buchanan. I always thought it was Rogers Buchanan. I used to get the families all mixed up, but I used to go there and say hello to. I know how corny this sounds. I do, but
it's a great cemetery. That's sited at another high point in the park.
Mm-hmm.
They put it up there, and there's 12 graves. The last one was the Nicholas Rogers IV, who died in 1850. He was the last one to be buried there.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also, there's another cemetery in the park that predates the city taking it over, 1854, and it's a mostly German-American cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And from what we researched, it was three cemeteries were moved and combined into this one cemetery that's in the park.
Oh.
And there's a church in Federal Hill that is in charge of the cemetery that keeps it up.
Oh, is that the one with the triple fountain? Or has that got a real fountain in it? I might have gotten that mixed up.
No, there's no fountain there.
No?
This is right over behind Safety City.
Oh,
I
see.
Paul Cemetery.
Yes.
And I attended a burial there of a woman who was very involved in the cemetery, probably in 2008 or 2009. So there have been some recent burials in the park.
Has there ever been any reported hauntings from in the cemetery?
Well, then there's supposed to be a third cemetery that people talk about, and that's the slave cemetery that's unmarked.
Mm.
And that is, people seem to think it's somewhere located near the mansion house. So between the three cemeteries, you know, there's all that going on in the park.
Is the slave cemetery, do we know that's where it's located, or we just know?
There's some people who think they have an idea, but we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
We're not sure where that is. But it seems to be, you know, people seem to concur that there is a cemetery there, but unmarked at this point.
Well, as you noted, the I think it was the last Buchanan who sold it to the city, and boy, that was quite a struggle there.
Right. The city was, you know, the American Parks Movement was happening around the country at that time. You know, the cities were getting bigger. They were dirty. They were crowded. And people were looking for some place where you could have a softer, quieter place to go to get away from the kind of, the quote, ills of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that was happening in Europe before it came to the United States. And Frederick Law Olmsted was one of the first people who was traveling around Europe and kind of saw these urban parks, like one right in the middle of Liverpool in London, you know, really crowded industrial place, but there was this big park. So he came back to the States and started promoting this movement. And in 1858, they decided in New York to put out a bid for somebody to design Central Park. And Olmsted won that. But the person who came in fourth was the person who won the bid to design Druid Hill.
And what was his name?
Just blanking on his name.
Well, you're not the only
one. He only was around for a couple of years because he died after 3 years.
Wasn't that sad? That was really sad. I remember reading that part. Whoa.
Yeah, but he spent a lot of time. You know, the whole idea of this English country landscape park, which, you know, is very early. Central Park and then Fairmount in Philadelphia and Druid Hill in Baltimore was the third of this in the country, where it was, you know, rolling hills, meadows, no straight lines. So all the, you know, in Druid Hill, if you drive through the roads, they're all windy. You kind of can get lost because you don't know where you're going. But that's the point of the park, to soften everything.
It does that. The very first time I got very upset in the park was when they put the fences up, but I understand now why.
You're talking about the zoo?
Yeah,
it was terrible for the park.
Oh, yeah, it was more or less like you couldn't go directly to where you wanted to go all the time. And I used to hang out there in the park when I was 8, 10 years old. And so, it was otherworldly, that's all. I mean, you know, for an artist to be in that kind of greenery. And then, you know, I didn't know how favorably this park, Root Hill Park, is seen in regards to Central Park and the park in Philadelphia, Fairmont. Is it Fairmont?
Yeah, Fairmont.
Yeah, I mean, this really might be, and I'm not hyping, one of the most beautiful parks, period, in the United States of America. Am I over-exaggerating?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I mean, there are 135 acres of woods in the north end of the park. The topography changes in the park. In the south end is kind of the coastal plain. It's rolling hills where all the, you know, they built all the ball fields. There's soccer and football and baseball and the basketball courts and the playgrounds are all in the southern end of the park, which is kind of flat. And then if you move to the northern end of the park, it's the Piedmont Plateau, and it's all rocky and hilly, and it was left undeveloped for one reason, you know, because of that. You couldn't really build on it. So you have these 135 acres of woods in the north end of the park. And like you said, when they put up the zoo fence in 1970, that was a requirement by the Zoological Society, basically to keep animals from getting in to the zoo to infect other animals with any kind of disease. It was a requirement.
Yeah.
But in a way, it was a tragedy on some level for the park because it cut off the whole southern end from the wooded northern end.
Oh.
So the only reason that people started going to the northern end was, you know, to do things that, you know, weren't the most positive things for a park. So for years, the city just cut all those roads off. They put blockades up so nobody could go back there.
Yeah.
And in 2008, the city built the Jones Falls Trail, like you had said, 2.75 miles winding through the south and north end of the park, and that opened up the park again for people to do good things.
Yeah.
So if people are listening and they haven't been to Druid Hill recently and they have their bike, I mean, you can ride along this beautiful trail around the reservoir, past the conservatory, in front of the zoo, and down through the woods. And you know, I think that this expression, you know, country in the city, you're in the woods, but you're in the middle of Baltimore City, and it just is like a wonderful experience that you don't get to do in many other places.
Yeah. The Civil War. What's the park's historical connection during the Civil War?
Well, the park was just purchased in 1860, and then the Civil War starts in 1861. And Baltimore was kind of that north-south divide, so there was a lot of activity happening around that. And it became a Civil War camp, part of the park, the southern end of the park, became a camp in the Civil War. And it was one of the, I think the Secretary of War, Stanton, assigned a General Birney to establish a, you know, colored troops in the park. So he, from what we read, he went down to Pratt Street and got slaves out of pens on Pratt Street and said, you know, if you want to join the war, you can be released. So, mm-hmm. I mean, what a choice.
Yeah.
Be a slave or go to war. Not a great choice, but that's what was happening at that time. And there was a first colored regiment, among other regiments, that were in the southern end of the park at that time.
Well, Baltimore at that particular time, as you note in the book, it was a really tough place to be for, in regards to let's just say anyone. I think you said it basically that the Abraham Lincoln, out of some 60,000 votes or something like that, got about 1,000 or something like that, somewhere in that region. I didn't know it was that.
Right, we were different. a southern leaning state at that point.
Yes, I still
but
think.
But one thing, in 1856, before Lincoln's, there was 78% voter turnout. That's an incredible thing that we would never experience today. And the two big topics at that time were slavery and also immigration. So immigration continues with us.
Mm-hmm.
But there's huge voter turnout. People were engaged in what was going on in the country.
Well, right now we're engaged in paying for this show, and we're going to take a break here. Druid Hill Park, the heart of historic Baltimore, with Eden Baldich Unger, the History Press, and as a matter of fact here, that's only one half of who we're talking about tonight, or we're talking with tonight, is Anne Draddy as well. And she's been with the park since the year 2000. Go to druidhillpark.org. And also the RawlingsConservatory.org. And for those into young adult fiction or interesting youngsters in science, you should check out Eden's page at YoungInventorsGuild.com.
This is Professor Joy Porter, author of Land and Spirit in Native America, which is available on Amazon.com. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back. 21st Century Radio. Our guest is Anne Draddy, co-author of Druid Hill Park, The Heart of Historic Baltimore, with Eden Baldich Unger, The History Press, 2008. Go to druidhillpark.org. Also, go to RawlingsConservatory.org. We'll touch a little bit more on the conservatory in a little while. And for those into young adult fiction or interesting youngsters in science, should check out Eden's page at YoungInventorsGuild.com. Okay, Anne, there are so many wonderful things in the park that we need to move into that, or we're going to be out of time without touching on them. The famous Three Sisters. When I think of the Three Sisters, I think of the Native Americans' beans, corns, and squash. But that's not what these Three Sisters are.
No, yeah, I don't know why they were named the Three Sisters, but we're talking about three ponds that were connected by
mm-hmm.
water.
Yeah.
And you might remember this, Bob. I mean, I'm not a native Baltimorean, but in the 1960s, from what we found out, that the Three Sisters were a destination point in the park from people around the city. That they came here, many as young as children, to play in the water in mm-hmm. these ponds that were in the woods that connected. And at the end of the 60s, the water was shut down and the ponds were closed up.
Oh,
and
yes.
They were, trees grew all in them and around them. And right now, the city has hired a consultant to redesign these to open them up again. So the design has been complete, and it's possible in the next couple of years that there will be construction to recreate these ponds.
Oh,
where
wonderful.
You'd be able to go, you know, on these, they'd put up new walls, and the idea would be that you'd be able to sit on the wall and dip your toes in the water and walk around these, you know, as a beautiful contemplative area in the pond, in the park that would be right along the Jones Falls Trail. So the hope is that they will be revitalized.
That's wonderful. I hope that does happen indeed. Maybe we can help out a little bit along those lines. Now, water is very important to Druid Hill Park, and I learned a great deal. That's why this book is so important. The famous springs and the healthy water. In question, you got a question mark after that. Tell us about the springs and the importance of water in Druid Hill Park.
Well, that was one of the stipulations when the city was looking for land. They wanted something, first of all, that was a minimum of 500 acres for this new park. They wanted something that was close to the city. At that point in 1860, the city line was North Avenue, and this was about a mile north of that. And the third thing was water. They felt like that was a very important thing to have to promote a relaxing environment. And Druid Hill had tons of little springs all over the place. And after the city purchased it, they started putting statues at the springs and so that you could come and bring your jug and get fresh water that was just flowing clean, fresh water. So that was a very standard behavior for a long time, really up until around the 1940s. And there are remnants of these springs. Most of them are really inside the zoo, and they're in the zoo in places that you don't really go to as public. But they're still in there, some of these beautiful sculptures and statues.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Where you could get the clean water.
Well, again, that's one of the great things about this book, because I wish I would have had this before 2008 when I used to walk around there to find out where all the statues, because I know one time Merlin Institute back there in, 1990s or so, came out with a booklet that included many of the statues and things like that. I was just always puzzled over some of them. I'm thinking of the Scottish,
William Wallace.
Yes, yes, I was one.
Amazing, huge statue overlooking the reservoir.
Yeah, oh boy, that really was something. But then I learned about the water system, what the Jones Falls water did in regards to this, made that water less healthy.
Well, what happened, the reason the water has become less healthy, and that this is, there were springs in many of the parks, but it's the development that happened, the more houses and more roads happened north of the park, so instead of the water penetrating into the forests and the grassland, it now goes onto the roads and the rooftops and then runs into the storm drains and the storm system. So it's not getting cleaned anymore. It's kind of dirty water that's coming in. Development creates the water. It creates pollution in the water.
I bet you a lot of our listeners never knew that there was boats on the lake and other areas. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, if you drive by the zoo and you look over to the right, you'll see a lake in there inside the zoo fence. And that, before the fence went up in 1970, that was part of the park. And in the summer, there was an island in the middle where you could rent rowboats and boat around. And then in the winter, you could go ice skating there.
Oh, my.
So it must have been a fantastic asset for the park.
Mm-hmm. I understand that they would also dam certain streams to create other areas to boat in?
That's the only place that I know of where you could boat.
Okay.
I hadn't heard of other places. But there were, in addition to, you know, there were three reservoirs in the park in the 1800s. You know, the Druid Hill Lake was built in 1871 because the reservoir system was stressed, so they needed some extra reservoir. And the lake was they used the first steam shovels in Baltimore to build it. And they packed it down with horse-drawn carts and rollers. I mean, it was very kind of what we would think of primitive. A similar dam was built in England at that time, and 250 people died. But in Baltimore, that That is from 1871. It's still in existence. It's our reservoir water today. And that, you know, when you're driving down 83 and you see that big hill with the Moorish Tower on top, that was a hand-built
tower.
Reservoir, hand-built clay wall, basically, to hold the water in. And then there were two other, there was a high-service reservoir, which, if you know where the Reptile House is.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah. That was the pumping station for the reservoir that is now where the ball fields are behind there. There was a reservoir there. And then there was a reservoir where 83 is on the southern end of the park called the Mount Royal Reservoir, and that's how Reservoir Hill got its name, from that reservoir.
Oh, yes. All right. Now, boy, we're running out of time, and I want to make sure we get to touch on some of this other stuff. I'd love to just take the time and talk about the other statues in the park. I mean, there were so many, especially those that were dealing with the various springs, that were so mysterious to me. I was like going on an archaeological dig somewhere through this particular place. But the zoo, we need to touch more a little bit on the zoo. Just how old is the zoo?
The zoo was around 1876, and they considered it maybe the third or fourth oldest zoo in the country. So we have the third oldest country landscape park and the third oldest zoo in Baltimore.
Isn't that something? Wow. And as you said, about 1970, when they fenced it off, that kind of changed things. And I was angry at the zoo, I got to tell you. I was angry because I didn't understand. I didn't know why they were. I thought they were putting them up, the fences up, to protect the animals from people. And I got very angry at people. I mean, because.
Understandable. It was a huge change in the park.
Yeah. But indeed, it wasn't that at all, though, that they were put up to protect the animals from other animals who certainly,
certainly
would have been a problem in one way or the other. Then we come to the conservatory. We touched on this earlier, but let's get into this a little bit more. How old is the conservatory?
Conservatory is 1888, the main building, the big Palm House building. That was the first one built. And that was, there was a young architect who was hired in 1863, George Aloysius Frederick. He was 19 years old, and he was hired to design everything in the park. He did. And everything pretty much that's still standing in the park, the pavilions, the Moorish Tower, and the conservatory, he designed all those. So he had a huge impact on the park, on how it was going.
19 years old.
19 years old. He also designed City Hall. He designed Silburn Mansion, multiple churches in town. He was a prolific Baltimore architect, but he was the park architect for over 30 years.
Mm, wow. Then, of course, the conservatory grew some other buildings there, right?
Right, right.
You want to tell us about them?
Well, now they have a Mediterranean house, a tropical house, and a desert. So I really would recommend, if you haven't been there, all those three houses. And then they have gardens outside. Right now in the park on Wednesday nights at the conservatory, the Friends of Druid Hill run a farmer's market every Wednesday night throughout the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have music once a month, and they have free yoga. It's a great opportunity to go to the farmer's market, go hear music, and wander through the conservatory. Or, you know, you can go to the conservatory. It's open 5 days a week. I think it's Tuesday through Sunday. And it's just a wonderful place to visit.
You don't have to pay to go into the conservatory.
No, it's free. You can give a donation. They request a donation, but you do not have to. I mean, it's a $2 donation, I think. But it's a great place. Not only for a Baltimore person to visit, but if you have anybody from out of town, it's a great place to take them.
I think it was sometime around 2004 or 2005, something happened and opened up at the conservatory that we attended, and I was just flabbergasted at the beauty of it because my childhood memories are a lot different than where it is now.
Oh, really? Yeah, they renovated it completely in 2004.
Oh, that's the.
They had shut it down for a couple of years because it had really been falling into disrepair. And all those windows, a lot of them had broken, and they had no money to repair them. But they did a complete overhaul and built some of the new houses. And they have just a room just for orchids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can get married there and have events there, and there's concerts there regularly. So it's a great, vibrant place in the park to visit. And there's a beautiful mural in the front on the ground by Joyce Scott, a local Baltimore artist.
It's on the ground?
Yeah, it's built into the stone on the ground.
How terrific. I don't think I saw that.
Yeah, it's right in front. And one of the things it depicts is the sheep, because on the Mansion House lawn, the city parks department employed a shepherd for many, many years, up until, I think, the 1930s or so.
Mm-hmm.
And we met a number of people when we were researching the book, who boys who had grown up going to hang out and visit the shepherd every day. There were two different shepherds who were there for, you know, over a 70-year period, I think.
And they loved that park. They took care of it. And the children, you know, you can imagine. Well, you don't have to imagine. You know how it affects the children to be able to go and you know, must have been almost like a storybook.
Right.
I remember seeing photographs in the Sun papers, especially around 1938, 1937, in which they would show the shepherd and his flock. But right now, we got to stop and pause here for our last break here on 21st Century Radio with our guest Andrade. The book is Druid Hill Park, The Heart of Historic Baltimore, with Eden Baldich Unger, The History Press, published in 2008. Please check out druidhillpark.org and also rawlingsconservatory.org. And for those into young adult fiction or interesting youngsters in science, they should check out Eden's page at younginventorsguild.com. Maybe in the future we'll do another show on that. We'll be back. How would you like to win a free copy of the book that we're talking about? Druid Hill Park, The Heart of Historic Baltimore by Eden Unger Baldich and Andrade. The History Press. Go to www.historypress.net. Now, if you know the answer to this hour's trivia question, you're going to win that book. Here's the question. When I last hosted 21st Century Radio, we led with the most important story of what nation sees genetically modified foods as an act of terrorism. That's right. Tell us, which nation holds that GMO foods are an act of terrorism? And in order to win, of course, you got to be qualified. And here's how to do it. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hi, this is Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin. I am a Jungian analyst, an author, and an advocate for a United Nations IF NGO World Conference on Women, and the author of Goddesses in Every Woman and Like a Tree. And I've just been interviewed on 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and we have covered the waterfront, from contemporary to archetypal to activism to all kinds of things. I think you will enjoy the program. I can be found at www.jeanbolin.com.
Well, thank you, Aunt Jean. Well, we have a caller who called in, and he wanted to mention, this is Arthur. I want to note this. We don't take callers on the air. He said he wanted to add some points off the air. He used to go to the park a lot as a boy with his dad, and he had three points of interest. One, the rowboats were only on the lake, or rowboats are only on the lake. Well, that's what it says here. There was a large house at the end of the park on the southwest side where the zoo director lived near Mondawmin. I think he's talking about Dr. Watson.
Right.
Oh, hi. Oh, yes. And they used to have horseback riding. The Arabs, which were the fruit vendors, had horses, and the stall were right there, and they would rent the horses out for 50 cents an hour for horseback riding. Yeah. Well, I wasn't. I was just probably 2 years old when all that happened. That's a wonderful memory. It really is. There is something so important about this park that I knew little or nothing about, and this is the history of the civil rights in the park. And would you please review this particular time period, because I was so shocked to find to learn the things that I learned during this long struggle that didn't end until somewhere in the late 50s or 60s, somewhere right around there.
Well, the park was segregated, like the city. I mean, there was enforced segregation. And Druid Hill, being one of the larger city parks, some of them were just white only, a lot of the parks. But Druid Hill had a white only and a black only area. And in Druid Hill, it was in the middle of the park where there was tennis courts and a swimming pool and picnic area. So the black families had to walk through to the middle of the park to get to the area that was, you know, the colored or Negro area. They called it the colored pool number two. And it was great. We interviewed a lot of people who were in their 80s who had been, you know, going to that pool before it had been desegregated, some of the lifeguards. And they talked about the community and the importance of the support system and the community they had in that pool before segregation. But the black pool, the colored pool was built in 1921, and the white pool, which is still in existence, was in 1924. And there were a lot of tennis players. The Baltimore Tennis Club was the colored folks were members of that. And then on next to the conservatory, there were clay courts, and you could only play there if you were white. And in the 1940s, the colored courts became so deteriorated that there were holes in them and cracks in them and weeds growing through them, and the city wasn't fixing them. So the Baltimore Tennis Club got together with the white folks who were part of a political group called the Young Progressives, and they decided to stage a tennis match between blacks and whites, which was illegal in the park system. It wasn't illegal in the city, but the parks, it was against park regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So on July 11th, 1949, four young whites and four young blacks went onto these tennis courts next to the conservatory and staged this match. And it was publicized ahead of time so that the police were there when the match started, and there were like about 500 people gathered watching this. And the police said, if you start playing tennis, we're going to arrest you. And that's what happened. They all got arrested, and they got taken away in the Black Mariah, which was the paddy wagon of the day. And that was a big, you know, a big turning point in some ways. But really, that was 49, and the park did not change its, you know, it officially changed its regulation. But if a young black woman went to get a permit for the tennis court, even after that time, she could still not get one.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until the 50s that it really things started changing. But, you know, it was a really tough time for the, you know, in that way, that, you know, the segregation. But we were really amazed when we talked to the people who were around at that time, and when desegregation kind of blew apart the black community in Druid Hill in
mm-hmm.
that way. Because yeah. everybody, of course, went to the white pool because they were allowed to. So the black pool closed down, and then the blacks became lifeguards at white pools, and they were really discriminated against. And
I bet.
So it was a complicated history, but that match in 1949 made national news. It was, you know, they were protesting before the 60s. You know, they were ahead of their time in that way.
Before we run out of time, I just wanted to mention you have a real good analysis of this between Dr. Bernard Harris and Robert Garrett that actually manifested it into these two fellows, one black, one white, and eventually Garrett, thank heavens, that was, I guess, 1960, did he just resign from the board?
He was forced to resign from the board.
Forced to resign.
Yeah.
Thank heavens.
Yeah, his time was up.
Whoa, was his
yeah.
time up?
Right.
So all the good things some of the Garrett family did, and that was one thing that was just so hateful as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And I'm glad that finally they had the strength to overcome that. Now, oh, we're almost out of time. What's going on in the park right now?
Well, the conservatory, I would say, is an active place. There's a lot of lectures, a lecture series there. They have a Sunday croquet where you can go and learn and play croquet there on Sundays. As I said, it's open Tuesdays through Sundays. The Friends of Drewer Hill are very active in the park. This on June 21st, they're having a solstice event, and that's they've instituted that in the last few years. So this is that the 21st on Friday night, or is that Saturday night?
It's a Friday night, I believe.
So Friday night at 9 o'clock in the park. I don't know if you've been in the park recently. The city paid, or the Friends group paid, for a guy to make some sculptures out of the old oak trees that had fallen down.
Oh, yes. That's
so these beautiful sculptures. Mm-hmm. And one of them, the one near the reservoir, is called the Green Man sculpture. And the Friends are having their solstice celebration with a bonfire and hay rides and music. So,
you know, that's really Celtic. That really gets right to the point.
Following the history of the park.
The Green Man.
The Green Man.
Oh, my. Well, we've done lots of shows on the Green Man.
You mentioned the art in the park when you were growing up, and that was people loved that, and it just has been revitalized in the last 2 years. They just had it about a month or so ago around the reservoir. They had art, so that's been reinstituted. They have a ride around the reservoir that's been going on now for 8 years or so. In the evenings, people can come and borrow bikes and ride the bikes around the reservoir. And the Jones Falls Trail now connects, starting at the Inner Harbor, goes all the way up to and through Druid Hill, and now goes up to Silburn Arboretum, so you can ride your bike safely on a trail all the way up there and through the park.
Fabulous. That's fabulous.
So there's lots of sports going on and just walking in the woods, and it's a very active and beautiful place to go.
Well, Andrade, I want to thank you for joining us, co-author of Druid Hill Park, The Heart of Historic Baltimore, with Eden Baldwich Unger, the History Press, druidhillpark.org, rawlingsconservatory.org, and maybe in the future you can join us for, as you note, for those who into the young adult fiction or interesting, where for science, for youngsters, etc., perhaps you can join us. And that is, I got that mixed up. Well, I'm sorry about that. Younginventorsguild.com. Go to that. Thank you for joining us, Annie.
Thank you so much, Bob.
You're very welcome.
Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Lissandra.